Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
A Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special, in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other world leaders have received assurances from the Taliban that foreign nationals and those with authorization to exit Afghanistan will be free to leave, as tensions and bloodshed escalate on the streets of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Rajiv Sial, Jason Burke, and Patrick Winter. The piece is titled Taliban Assure World Leaders They Will Let Eligible People Leave Afghanistan. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other world leaders have received assurances from the Taliban that foreign nationals and those with authorization to exit Afghanistan will be free to leave, as tensions and bloodshed escalate on the streets of Kabul. On Sunday, 29th of August, U.S. military forces launched a strike against a vehicle which the Americans claimed was full of ISIS terrorists who were allegedly planning to attack Kabul airport. According to reports, there were multiple fatalities, including a number of Afghan children. The U.S. military has confirmed it is assessing the possibility of having killed or injured civilians in the airstrike. A significant number of British citizens told The Guardian they continue to wait at Kabul airport in the hope of being rescued despite the terror threats and the departure of all UK troops at the weekend. They sent video footage of several people clasping UK passports and pleading for help. Desperate Afghans have been told to cross the border into neighbouring countries to escape the Taliban takeover. On Monday, 30th of August, the United Nations Security Council is expected to discuss the Taliban's reassurances, revealed in a statement on Sunday evening after deepening concerns over the plight of thousands of Afghans with Western links who are at their mercy. France and Britain were expected to table an emergency United Nations Security Council resolution calling for any new Afghan government to back a safe zone at Kabul airport to allow evacuation efforts to continue, French President Emmanuel Macron said, though a Whitehall source claimed Emmanuel Macron's comments were premature. In a joint statement released on Sunday by the British government along with the United States and more than 90 other countries, it was confirmed that the Taliban had said anyone who wished to leave the country could do so, though the Taliban's pledges will be greeted with skepticism. The joint statement said, "We have received assurances from the Taliban that all foreign nationals and any Afghan citizen with travel authorization from our countries will be allowed to proceed in a safe and orderly manner to points of departure and travel outside the country." Last week, the Taliban caused shockwaves by moving to prevent Afghan citizens from leaving the country, declaring the route to Kabul airport open only to foreign nationals. Western military forces have been trying to evacuate Afghans who have supported foreign operations as they fear they and their families could be in harm's way for working with Western powers during the 20-year war. The Taliban's latest assurances are part of delicate negotiations as the new government seeks to work with foreign governments. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Sunday that if the Taliban want diplomatic recognition and aid funding, they would have to ensure safe passage for those who want to leave the country. Dominic Raab, the British Foreign Secretary, is expected to use a US-chaired meeting with ministers from Qatar, Turkey, fellow G7 partners and NATO on Monday
to stress the importance of ensuring the Taliban stand by their commitment to allow safe passage for foreign nationals and Afghan citizens authorized to enter third countries. In a further development, Britain is being urged to spearhead an international plea to fund refugee camps in countries bordering Afghanistan. John Healey, the Shadow Defense Secretary, said ministers had failed to involve critical partners in the region to avoid the current crisis, despite knowing for months that the withdrawal of U.S. forces would happen this year. Britain must lead international efforts to get neighboring countries to set up safe haven camps, he said. There has to be hard cash on the table to fund safe haven camps and the countries willing to take them. It comes after 15,000 people were evacuated from Afghanistan by British troops over the course of nearly 2 weeks under Operation Pitting, believed to be the largest evacuation mission since the Second World War. Whitehall sources believe that up to 9,000 other people with links to the British government could be left behind, however. Those remaining will be expected to reach a third country, such as Pakistan, Tajikistan, or Uzbekistan, in order to be resettled in Britain. The British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sir Laurie Bristow, who had remained in the country and relocated the embassy to Kabul Airport to process as many evacuees as possible, has now arrived back in the United Kingdom on Sunday, 29th of August, landing at RAF Bryce Norton in Oxfordshire. The final flight prompted criticism from senior military figures over the role of the British government, which was accused of failing to act on pleas to ensure the safety of Afghans who had helped soldiers. General Lord Dannatt, the former head of the British Army, told Times Radio, back in July, 45 senior officers wrote to the government saying they are people we are concerned about, and if we don't do the right thing, their blood will be on our hands. It is unfathomable why it would appear that the government was asleep on watch. Vice Admiral Ben Key, the Chief of Joint Operations who commanded Operation Pitting, admitted there was a sense of sadness that not all could be saved. Speaking at RAF Bryce Norton on Sunday morning, 29th of August, he said, "I pay testament to everything that has been achieved by coalition forces. In the end, we know there are some really sad stories of people who have desperately tried to leave, that no matter how hard our efforts, we have been unsuccessful in evacuating." Meanwhile, Colonel Richard Kemp, the former commander of British soldiers in Afghanistan, told Times Radio that Britain now faced a great danger from terrorism. Witnesses on Sunday reported an explosion near Kabul Airport, and television footage showed black smoke rising into the sky. Taliban officials confirmed the US account. The strike came 3 days after a suicide attack at Kabul Airport that killed more than 180 people, including at least 3 British nationals and 13 US service members. The Taliban condemned the strike, saying it had violated Afghanistan's sovereignty. Zabihullah Mujahid, a spokesman for the Taliban, said civilians had suffered casualties in the US strike on Sunday and a house had been hit. The Taliban and the U.S. military have increased security around Kabul Airport since last Thursday's attack. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said on Saturday, 28th of August, that Washington believed there were still specific and credible threats against Kabul Airport. "We would expect future attempts," he said. "We are monitoring these threats very, very specifically, virtually in real time."
a simple question.
The Ministry of Defence in central London has been busy since 2001. That's when the United Kingdom and America invaded Afghanistan to drive out Taliban forces. Some say this politically motivated escapade owed as much to gesture politics as it did to any military objective. After initial success in limiting the area of operations of the Taliban, the battle for hearts and minds began to be lost as the attempt to win through military power failed the West.
Britain has been closely involved with the campaign in Afghanistan. It is, in fact, just an example of similar initiatives involving Britain in Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. There is no sign that the British government will shift away from this militaristic approach as the UK struggles to adapt its international strategies in a new world order where it is not as powerful as it once was. All this war has damaged these countries in economic, social, and political ways. The public are deprived of health, housing, and safety. Businesses fail. Politicians compete to control anarchic and angry populations with the ever-present prospect of insurgency. Since the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, has been key to much of this action, some argue NATO has served to destabilize the entire Middle East, while making Britain more of a target for enemies.
So what was the result of this and other military escapades in the Middle East and the surrounding region? Will the UK choose peaceful solutions in future? Or is the financial incentive just too great for the UK to give up on the arms industry? These are simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do people here in central London feel about the UK's military involvement in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Iraq? We put that to the public. Here's what they told us.
I don't think the British public know enough about what's going on there. I used to live in the Middle East. I know nothing about any kind of wars or any bad. I was in the Emirates, and I was an expat there, and I knew nothing but positivity and just so, I'm so accepted by the Emirati people, and yet we hear all this stuff about Iran and Iraq and all this Afghanistan, but what is actually happening? What is the problem? I don't feel like I know.
Well, to be honest, as a country, we've always got involved in everybody else's problems as a way to benefit this country, and it's about time to stop sticking their nose in.
I think UK should put more active participation. I don't think the country is doing enough in terms of global causes. So my view is that it should, being a superpower, it should rather be taking into account what's going around as well. Yeah. So that's, they might be doing it to a certain extent, but that's not enough with whatever is happening around. So.
Well, I'm born in Afghanistan, so I kind of was at first hand at the situation there, my parents, how they had to flee, and we've obviously come over here to start a new life. I get it from a government point of view. We've got to take action. When there are regimes like the Taliban that unfortunately, at the cost of civilians and normal people, need to be addressed, they need to be challenged. But at the same time, in the last 20 years, the occupation, the alliance forces, how much good have they done? And now that they're leaving, what will that leave? What legacy will that leave? So I don't know enough to kind of say one way or the other. I am skeptical, but also I appreciate the intervention is necessary because there are countries where, you know, leaders, dictators go on and on for decades. They don't take the country forward. So I appreciate the intervention, but I don't know if it was in the last 20 years.
Our involvement in all those wars has always been a disaster. I think we first invaded Afghanistan 200 years ago. There's never been anything in any of those wars that hasn't left a worse position. Hundreds of thousands of people killed, and usually chaos. we were always, when I was born in 1945, I grew up in that post-war world where we were told all our wars were about trying to create a democracy. They weren't. They're about getting control of oil in the Middle East and making money out of all of these things. We never created a democracy anywhere.
The 21st century has been a century of war for Britain. In fact, the last years of the 20th century were also in the era of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and the so-called Chicago Doctrine, the so-called right to protect, although they're highly discriminating in whom they intend to protect, and of course end up killing vast numbers of people in order to protect them, like the famous American general in Vietnam, in the Vietnam War, who said we had to destroy that village in order to save it. It has been a colossal blunder, as well as a terrifically large crime, one of the great crimes of British history, and we have many crimes in British history. The invasion and occupation of first Afghanistan, then Iraq, the destruction of Libya, the attempt to destroy Syria, the participation in the no war but no peace with Iran, the participation in the attacks on the poorest people in the region in Yemen have all been a shameful mark on the British record, which, as I say, has many centuries of such marks.
What does the public feel was actually achieved by the UK's military action in and around the Middle East over the last 20 years?
Well, we haven't achieved anything. So my husband was out there, fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're now looking at, we're going back again. So we haven't achieved anything. We've just, it's done full circle. So we haven't got anywhere. Hasn't done anything.
To just continue to disrupt it. That's all the intention is. I'm not particularly very happy with the way that we kind of manage ourselves and what we've done in the Middle East. It's not very good.
Nothing at all. Like I said, I've never heard any good come out of it. We're going, keep going back and spending all this money. I don't know on what at all. So nothing at all.
Should ask my son who studied GCSE. You know, he was taught, this is what he studied, which was the Middle East, and, you know, from, you know, Ben Gurion and all the setting up of that. To be honest, it seems to be it's dominated by the American politics, not necessarily British politics, but by supporting, I suppose, Americans. The British are seen as being complicit in terms of what they're doing. What do I think? As I said, there are sides to both. There are both sides in terms of what there are, you know.
The Middle East hasn't moved on a whole lot in the last 20 years, but the UK has been involved for 800 years in many different places. It depends on, as I said, the purpose. If you're not seeing any improvements, you have to question why you're there.
If I think back, we have never been involved anywhere in the Middle East that hasn't been a disaster. I grew up really worried that one day I'd have to join the army and I'd be sent. I grew up really worried that I'd be forced into the army, I'd end up in a war somewhere in the Middle East. And the simple fact is that literally all this has been about the control of oil, not about democracy or defending people's rights. We have been responsible, along with America. We've been the number two in this. America's been the main lead in all this. And hundreds of thousands of people have died because of it, and we've ended up with a legacy of really unpleasant dictatorial regimes. Where in the Middle East have we created a nice democracy? We haven't.
Well, nothing good has been achieved for Britain, that's for sure. The demonstration that I talked about, which is a demonstration of the United States' fading power rather than growing power, has pushed people together, for example, that might not otherwise have ended up together. It's pushed Russia and China together, almost as one country, economically speaking, currency-wise, militarily. It has, in strategic politics, it's pushed China and Russia together, making a very powerful adversary indeed. It has emboldened fanatic Takfiri extremism all over the world, including in our own country. I've just been reading the inquest details of the Takfiri murderer who went wild in a street I used to live in, a man who had been in maximum security from the age of 16 and by the age of 20 was dead, but having stabbed multiple innocent people in between those two dates. It has, of course, created a new bloc in the world, which involves Iran, China, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, and so on, which will not be in the United States' imperial interest to have done.
The UK is a pivotal part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that's NATO. But with all this military activity, when it comes to keeping the British public safe, has the UK's involvement in NATO done more harm than good?
To be honest, I just think we're in it because we're Britain, and that's it. We have to be part of it. I don't think we achieve anything from it. It's just to say that we're involved in it, but America will just do whatever they can for themselves, I think.
It's hard to say. I mean, you look at the July attack, you look at 2000, obviously, in the US, and you look at lots of the terrorist attacks. Where does it come from? Where does it boil down to? And it's, you know, individuals again, making that decision based on perhaps an ideology, their own personal views, and they go and act. So would a government decision or would a treaty like the NATO treaty prevent that? I don't know. And when it was set up, it was a great idea. And again, I appreciate what it can help with, but does it go far enough? Are these people that are sitting around talking about these situations and then putting actions in place, is it going far enough to really drive into the root cause of these individuals that are acting?
I believe they should. I mean, every country should have the have a freedom to equip themselves. But as long as it's been used for summoning the borders, yeah, not for sort of putting pressure on other countries. Yeah. So yes, every country has the right to sort of equip themselves with whatever weapons and whatever things they need to do to secure their boundaries. So I have no problem with that. Yeah.
If anything, we seem to be going in the opposite direction in the last 10 years. Maybe in the early years there was some improvements, but it's definitely stoked fires, not just the UK, everybody's involvement, because there's different purposes for you being there. And in short, no, in the recent years, it's probably getting worse. And that's because any time you step into somebody's territory and use certain tactics, you're going to upset people. You don't have to go too far. You can come back locally and realise that if you continue with the same policies that don't seem to be working, you're going to upset people, and people will start to turn around and see what they can do. And if there isn't another power, another government that can support them, they'll start to take on that pressure themselves and revolt.
Basically, when NATO was set up just after the end of the Second World War, we were being told we were under a threat from the Soviet Union, Russia. And we now know, given all the data has been released, there was never a threat. Stalin had no intention of attacking the West. This was all about creating this military complex that we controlled in Europe, not the Soviet Union. And the simple fact is people should have been allowed to create their own governments in their own time. We were involved in so many wars throughout all my life. It's been every single one of them. It's been not about democracy. It's been about economic interests.
Britain's involvement in NATO is an extremely expensive way of defending ourselves, even though we, in fact, have no discernible enemies that could attack us beyond the very Takfiri extremist terrorists that we have been doing so much to help in places like Libya, in places like Syria. NATO is no defense at all against a man with a samurai sword in a park going around cutting people's heads off. Britain has no nuclear enemy and no country, no state, which is conceivably going to pose a risk to British security. So we're paying a lot of money and paying a high political price for being involved with, you call it NATO, but it's really just the United States' gang, you know, and it would be quickly dispensed with if other NATO countries began to oppose American adventurism in Latin America, for example. Not many people know that that well-known North Atlantic power, Colombia, is currently a candidate member for NATO. But if any country or group of countries began to oppose NATO's involvements in different parts of the world, it would quickly be dispensed with. This is the United States' coalition of the killing.
The direct cost to America of the Afghanistan conflict is estimated at $2 trillion. In terms of death toll, in Libya, deaths are estimated at 30,000. The figure in Afghanistan is over 115,000 dead. In Yemen, the number exceeds 130,000. For Syria, those killed has passed 500,000. And for Iraq, it exceeds 600,000. Thus, the total official estimate of dead in these five countries alone is 1.375 million. This is almost certainly an underestimate.
After 20 years of war in Afghanistan and elsewhere, does the public think the UK will choose a more peaceful approach in the future, or will the next 20 years just be more of the same?
Not really. I have a cousin who works in the army in Israel, and it looks like it's something that's going to keep going on forever. There's always some sort of massive thing breaking out, and loads of people are dying and feeling terrified, so I don't know.
When you go into a country to make things better but have a backdoor deal to sell arms, that may not be directly, maybe indirectly going back to that source country as well, you have to question it.
I don't think so. Human nature, you know, we have this territorial kind of ideology or I don't know, I guess it's a person's survival of the fittest, sorry, the Darwin's theory, and we group together and we want to have our own sort of space, and I think we should educate ourselves a bit better. We should help each other, support each other, and hopefully bring about change within ourselves in order to impact the environment, the community that we live in. And we'll be living in a better place, but I don't know if we'll ever remove conflict, because that's just human nature.
More the same. I can't see this ending. I can't see how this is actually going to end. Like I said, I think it's just going to constantly just go round in circles. There is just no end to this, is there? Now we've started it, how do you end a war once you've started a war? There is no end, is there? It's tit for tat. It's just going to keep going round and round.
Well, it's quite clear, now that America's decided to pull out, we've decided to pull out, it's going to be up to the people in Afghanistan. The trouble is, I'm not a supporter of the Taliban, of course. I mean, and imposing a religion on people is wrong. I want to live in a world where everyone is free to live their life as they choose, not to be told you've got to support this religion, that religion, live this or that life. Just let people be themselves.
Unfortunately, I think the next 20 years will be very much like the last 20 years. Beyond 20, no one could safely hazard a guess. But we are locked into this alliance with the United States. The United States is fading, but still dangerous. Even the broken teeth of an old tiger can bite. And as long as we're locked into being the tail of that old tiger, I'm afraid we'll have to follow the head.
The UK is the second biggest arms dealer in the Middle East behind America. How will British arms exports be affected following the global economic problems caused by COVID? And is Britain even more dependent on the arms trade now?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. There's a lot of decisions that are driven by, and there's a lot of things that come out of that. Stopping that, would it prevent the wars that are happening, and would it prevent some of the issues that are in these countries, in Middle East, in Afghanistan, in other countries? I don't know. But certainly, again, the government needs to be taken to account for those actions and those trades and transactions. I understand that we're an economy. I understand that the life situation here is better. You know, if I was in Afghanistan and I'd grown up in Afghanistan, the education that I would have had would have been nothing compared to what I have had living in the UK. And I'm very grateful for that. But again, it needs to be taken into account and it needs to be challenged, and we need to talk about it more and be more aware of it moving forward.
Well, I think probably it's going to mean that more countries seem to be more worried about it themselves, because they've got to look after what's happening in their own countries. So they're maybe not looking and keeping an eye on what's going abroad very much, because the pandemic causes huge issues in your own country.
I hope not. I mean, I don't know too much about it, but I definitely hope that people will realise that it's not the way forward. But yeah, like I said, I don't really know much about it. But I don't think that it's a productive use of forces and money.
Well, we're not financially reliant. It's quite small as a proportion of our national economy. But the simple fact is, if you look at this, half of all the military spending in the world is by the United States of America. I mean, literally, every other country in the world together just equals what America spends on its military. And the tragedy is, all throughout most of my life, British governments, Labour or Conservative, have just been going along with what America wants. Fortunately, for my generation, the then Labour government, Harold Wilson, refused to get involved in the war in Vietnam. Otherwise, you wouldn't be interviewing me now. I'd be dead.
Well, where there's muck, there's brass, we say in this country. Where there are dirty things, there's money to be made. In this case, where there's brass in the form of arms exports, there's muck to be gathered. And the muck may be lucre, but it's filthy lucre. And I don't expect that to change. It's a symptom of Britain's industrial and manufacturing decline that just about the best things that we make nowadays are weapons. Weapons which, in the end, pierce the skin and the heads of overwhelmingly innocent people. A man's just gone to prison in the United States of America for 4 years for exposing the fact that drones, the kind of drones we routinely make and routinely sell and see you routinely used, kill 90% innocent civilians. There's blood on the hands of Britain's weapons manufacturers, but they're not going to stop or go out of business anytime soon.
Since 2001, the UK has backed conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Britain is also the second largest arms exporter to the Middle East. Britain has therefore made literally billions of pounds worth of business through the sale and use of weapons in these countries and beyond.
...20 years and countless deaths later, with the Taliban once again advancing in Afghanistan and the region in conflict, Britain has made a fortune out of war, but at the cost of lives and peace. The UK could change course tomorrow, but some suggest that for Britain PLC, war is just too profitable to let peace get in the way.
We'll be right back. follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Chun Yun Mi, a respiratory disease specialist at Uha Women's University Medical Center in Seoul, South Korea, said the Delta variant of the coronavirus is a strain that is most optimized for widespread transmission. We now present you an article concerning this issue written jointly by Hyun Shin and Swati Pandey. The piece is titled, Highly Contagious Delta Variant Sweeps Asia, Prompting Curbs as Vaccination Remains Tepid. Highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus is surging through Asia in recent days, with record numbers of infections in Australia and in South Korea, prompting some countries to tighten curbs and others to hasten vaccination efforts. The variant, first detected in India in December of last year, has spread to about 100 countries, and the World Health Organization, WHO, warned recently that it could soon become the dominant form of the coronavirus. It is also driving a spike in cases in Japan, casting a pall over this month's Olympic Games. On Friday, 2nd of July, Australia's New South Wales state, its most populous state, reported the biggest daily rise in new cases so far this year. Total cases in the state in the latest outbreak have topped 200, a majority caused by the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Sydney, home to a fifth of the country's 25 million population, is halfway through a two-week lockdown to contain the outbreak, which has alarmed authorities amid a sluggish nationwide vaccination drive. Professor Jill Carr, a virologist with the College of Medicine and Public Health at Flinders University, said, "I think the vaccine will certainly reduce the disease. It will certainly reduce hospitalization, but will certainly have the virus circulating in the community for those people who aren't vaccinated." Australia, like several other countries in Asia, has struggled to inoculate people as initial successes in containing the pandemic led to vaccine hesitancy, and manufacturers were slow to ship vaccine doses. Australia has fully vaccinated only 6% of its population, while Japan has vaccinated 12% of its population. Japan reported on Wednesday, 30th of June, that the Delta variant of the coronavirus now accounts for nearly a third of all cases in the eastern part of the country, including in Tokyo, and that could grow to 50% by mid-July. Japanese government sources told the Reuters news agency Tokyo and three neighboring prefectures are among areas under a quasi-state of emergency set to run through to 11th of July, and a recent uptick in infections had officials leaning towards keeping restrictions in place. On Friday, 2nd of July, Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike reiterated that a ban on spectators for the Olympic Games, which start on 23rd of July, would be an option if the coronavirus situation worsened in Japan. In South Korea, officials said on Friday, daily coronavirus cases topped 800, the highest in nearly 6 months, with vaccination below 10% of the population. The average number of new infections in the country has risen for 10 days straight, and authorities in Seoul have delayed relaxing social distancing measures. Chun In-mi, a respiratory disease specialist at Uha Women's University Medical Center in Seoul, South Korea, said the Delta variant is a strain that is most optimized for widespread transmissions. She said the cases of Indonesia, India, and Britain show that not just Korea, but many other countries will need to rethink their vaccine strategy and reopening plans. Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous country, imposed emergency measures that begin on Saturday, 3rd of July, and remain until 20th of July to contain a spike in the number of cases. In India, the number of new infections has eased to two-month lows since hitting a peak of 400,000 a day in May, with the government focusing on mass vaccinations. The United States has also seen a rise in Delta variant infections in parts of the country where vaccination rates remain low, and the White House said on Thursday, 1st of July, that it would send special assistance to those hotspots. Europe, too, is battling an increase in infections, which the World Health Organization has blamed on crowds at Euro 2020 football stadiums. It has warned that a new wave was inevitable if people did not remain disciplined. Germany said recently it expects the variant, the Delta variant, to account for up to 80% of infections this month, and Portugal imposed nighttime curfews. The fresh cases have put a damper on summer tourism in the European continent, although the launch of a European Union COVID-19 travel certificate may prompt more travel. Europe's drug regulator said on Thursday, 1st of July, that COVID-19 vaccines approved in the European Union offered protection against all coronavirus variants, including the Delta variant. In Asia, international tourism is largely suspended. The exception is Thailand's tourist island of Phuket, which reopened on Thursday, 1st of July, to fully vaccinated travelers from overseas, in a step towards reviving a battered tourism industry in Thailand. Still, Thailand on Friday reported the third straight day of record coronavirus deaths. The Alpha variant of the virus, first detected in the United Kingdom, is still the dominant variant in the country, although authorities said they expect the Delta variant to dominate over the next few months. Khun Noan Ung Chusak, advisor to the health ministry, said in Bangkok, "It is nearly 40% within this month or next. It will all be the Delta variant of the coronavirus." Referring to the rising death toll, he said, "If this keeps going, we cannot survive." World Health Organization WHO calls for better monitoring of Euro 2020 football matches as COVID cases rise again in Europe, fueled by the deadly Delta variant of the coronavirus that is racing around the globe. Hundreds of cases have been detected among spectators attending the Euro matches taking place across Europe, which carriers of the Delta strain detected in Copenhagen, Denmark, and infected Scots and Finns returning from London and St. Petersburg, Russia, respectively. Russia posted record virus deaths for a third day running on Thursday, 1st of July, while in Britain, where the Euro semi-final and final take place next week, infections are soaring despite a strong vaccination drive. The United Nations Agency's Europe Director, Hans Kluge, told a press conference, "There will be a new wave in the World Health Organization European region unless we remain disciplined." Hans Kluge warned that the region had seen a 10% rise in cases over the past week, driven by increased mixing, travel, gatherings and easing of social distancing restrictions. Asked about whether the Euro Championship was potentially acting as a super spreader event, Hans Kluge replied, "I hope not, but this can't be excluded." According to an Agence France-Presse tally, the coronavirus has killed more than 3.9 million people worldwide. On Thursday, 1st of July, the European Medicines Agency, the EMA, said 24 of the vaccine appeared to provide protection against the Delta variant of the virus based on real-world evidence. But while some 3 billion jabs have been administered worldwide, the global vaccine drive has highlighted stark inequalities between countries, with low-income nations having only given an average of one vaccine shot per 100 people. Vaccine skepticism has also been an issue for many countries, including Russia, prompting the Russian President Vladimir Putin to urge people on national television to get the jab. On Thursday, 1st of July, Russia reported about 672 deaths over the past 24 hours, setting yet another pandemic record. Catherine Smallwood, senior emergency officer at World Health Organization Europe, told reporters, "What we need to look at is around the stadia. How are people getting there? Are they traveling in large crowded convoys of buses? Are they taking individual measures when they are doing that?" She added that it was also important to look at what was happening after the football games, for instance, if fans gathered in crowded bars. Should this mixing happen, there will be more cases. The concerning situation in Europe coincides with the launch of an European Union-wide COVID certificate meant to ease travel for those living in the 27 member states. The document, essentially a QR code available on smartphones or on paper, shows whether the bearer is vaccinated with one of the EU's approved jabs, whether they have recovered from an infection or recently tested negative. But the surge in the Delta variant of the coronavirus could put an abrupt end to this, triggering an emergency break provision suspending the certificate's acceptance.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A top Iranian official has condemned U.S. President Joe Biden for what he called illegally threatening the Islamic Republic. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said Biden's emphasis on using other options with regard to Iran's nuclear program establishes Tehran's right to reciprocate. The reaction followed a meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett at the White House. During the meeting, Biden said he was putting diplomacy first on Iran's nuclear issue, but added he would be prepared to turn to other options. By diplomacy, the U.S. president was pointing to the talks in Vienna, Austria, to reinstate the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which was abandoned by former U.S. President Donald Trump in 2018. Biden also said he remains committed to ensuring that Iran never develops a nuclear weapon, while Iran has time and again rejected the accusation and stressed the fact that it seeks nuclear technology for peaceful purposes and not for developing weapons. Biden's threat of unspecific options came after Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, accused Iran of seeking a nuclear weapon. Gantz said military action should be considered as a plan B to prevent Tehran from accessing a nuclear warhead. That's while, unlike Iran, Israel is not a party to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, known as NPT, and is the only country in the region to have a nuclear arsenal. Israel's possession of nuclear warheads poses a significant threat to regional stability. The regime has carried a bombing campaign in Syria for the past years. It has threatened Iran militarily on numerous occasions and conducted sabotage attacks against the country. And when it comes to Hezbollah, Israel has repeatedly threatened to destroy the resistance group.
They can reach out and touch Iran anytime they feel like it. The question, of course, is what will Iran do if they are attacked? And that's what the Americans have to consider. And their Israeli masters.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the current U.S. administration is not different from the former government of President Donald Trump, who abandoned an international nuclear deal and unleashed the most draconian sanctions on Iran. The leader also said, quote, "Behind the scenes of foreign policy, smile and self-righteous talk, America is a predatory wolf that sometimes turns into a cunning fox. An example is the current situation in Afghanistan." Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. has a nerve to behave in a way as if it was Iran which walked away from the nuclear deal. He also blasted France, Britain and Germany for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. The leader said the trio's obstructionism in implementing the accord is no less than that of the U.S. The leader made the remarks in a meeting with President Ebrahim Raisi and his newly formed cabinet on Saturday.
So we've got basically more of the same. We've got the Trump administration with a different face that supposedly is kindlier and friendlier, but is actually just as opposed to Iran being a self-sufficient country with a functioning economy that helps its people. This is what the United States and Israel don't want.
U.S. President Joe Biden has said that rejoining the nuclear agreement is one of his top foreign policy priorities. But he has been refusing to take any steps to bring Washington back to compliance with the accord. The Biden administration has shown an unusual urge to maintain key elements of sanctions imposed by his predecessor as leverage to pressure the Islamic Republic. On the other hand, Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. That is, Iran is able to see the effect of the removal of sanctions in practice.
On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd.